I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Julie Gould, and this is the Nature Jobs Podcast. In this month's episode, we're talking about the importance of networking, and we've got a real life story of how your career can successfully alternate between stints in academia and in industry.
When we're hunting, you know, a big game, we will travel like crazy and we'll work very hard. But when we kill it, we get to eat it. And after we eat it, we sleep. And then we get up and we hunt again. And here it just seems like it's sort of unrelenting.
That was Peter Fisk, a longtime friend of Nature Jobs. He actually wrote a column last year in February about his personal experience on what to do if your job is at risk and the importance of career planning. His article, Look Before You Leap, actually turned out to be one of the most widely read Nature Careers article from last year. So definitely worth a read. At the time of writing the column, Peter had a sudden change of career. He was CEO at Pax Water Technologies, which was acquired by UGSI Solutions in January 2017. Was that something that you had time to prepare for, or was it something that came on rather suddenly?
It came on rather suddenly. When a company becomes an acquisition target, a lot of things happen very quickly. And most of the time, you're very busy during the transaction, so you don't really have much time to think about, you know, what happens next, including whether I'll even have a job at the end of the transaction. And it is not unusual for the CEO of the acquired company to be dismissed. And so I was already emotionally prepared that that might be the outcome.
Thankfully, Peter's story does have a happy ending. He had developed a great habit, networking, and through a conversation with an old friend, he found out about an opportunity that fit his skills and research interests perfectly. Peter has now been working as the director of the Water Energy Resilience Institute at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab in California for over a year. But it has been 16 years since he left academia the first time.
Julie, people in research work so hard. Oh my God, they work all the time. And I, you know, when I was a young scientist at Lawrence Livermore Lab, yeah, I worked 6 days a week pretty regularly. But it seems like the intensity has increased since I've been gone.
Oh, really? So just longer
yeah.
hours and more hard working?
Kind of more projects. So whereas before a postdoc might have a single project that they're focused on and might be able to enjoy that they're on a single project. Here, each postdoc might have 3 separate projects to jump between, and a PI might have 10. So it's just really, it's really scattered, and it's, you know, it's interesting. I don't think that the job satisfaction has gone up in the 15 years.
I was just about to ask, how do you feel that yeah. has had an impact on the way that people see their careers in academia?
Yeah, I think that it's just a very intense experience. And we work hard in the private sector. We certainly do. And when we're hunting, you know, a big game, we will travel like crazy and we'll work very hard. But when we kill it, we get to eat it. And after we eat it, we sleep. And then we get up and we hunt again. And here it just seems like it's sort of unrelenting. There's no you know, you finish a project and it's a real triumph, right? But you're right back, you know, the very next morning, you're back onto the next thing.
And how are you feeling adapting to this new way of working?
Oh my God, it's horrible. No, I'm just, it's fun. But I will say that the two things I noticed, first of all, is that there is no end to the volume of work. I mean, it's like an ideal gas. It will expand to fill whatever vessel of time you give it. And then the other thing that I notice is that it is a very solitary life. Even in a national laboratory with many different researchers, most of the time people are working genuinely on their own. And in the private sector, there's just a lot more interaction, a lot more, you know, when we would go on a sales call, you'd be going with somebody else. You'd have a lot of time to discuss both before and after what's going on. And I find here that most of the time the faculty are alone. And that was one of the things that originally kind of drove me away from research.
And so what is it that's brought you back?
We describe the job in the private sector, Julie, as business development. And in business development, what you have to do is you come in and try to identify new opportunities for the business to grow. And so that's what I've done. I've come back here and I'm going to help Lawrence Berkeley Lab really grow its water research programs.
So apart from networking, what other tips, I mean, especially based on your own experience as well, do you have for people on staying flexible and positive when it comes to seeing that you know, the market, the career market has moved on?
I think we spend a lot of time as scientists believing that because we have a degree in one area, it's not only that we cannot practice in another area, but we're almost like we shouldn't. Like it's almost fraudulent for us to represent ourselves as somehow competent in anything other than the discipline that we were trained. And that's really something that we need to frankly unteach grad students today. People in the outside world in industry, they don't care where you went to your university. They don't even really care what field you were in. What they care about is what you can do and what you're willing to try. And the nice thing about, you know, scientists and engineers is they tend to be very smart, very resourceful people who are able to, you know, use a lot of different tools. So I think flexibility starts from within. It starts from an internal decision and a belief that you can do it if you try. And then the other side of flexibility is making sure that you have a range of technical skills. And they're things that just will always be important. It'll always be important to know the basics of information technology, whether you can generate a decent program in Perl or Ruby, or whether you just know how to run a very advanced spreadsheet with all sorts of formula and models within it. Those basic skills that we use as part of getting our job done, those are very valuable skills in the outside world. And so making sure that you have that broad skill set is important.
Based on your own experience of having worked in academia, left, and now come back, what advice do you have for young researchers about moving in between the academic and industry sectors?
One thing I am seeing is that researchers are realizing that they need to have a portfolio of sponsors for their research, and that they need to think about doing both applied and basic research at the same time. And so I'm seeing today that successful academics are doing a combination of cutting-edge research. Some of them are also consulting for industries and actually bringing in substantial personal income as a result. Some of them are realizing that a combination of working for federal-level research sponsors and state-level research sponsors are important. And then I know some researchers who are orienting their graduate students such that at least one chapter of their thesis is working on an applied problem, and even in some cases working, you know, as a consultant, for example, in an industrial setting. And what those grad students gain is skills and experience of working in directly in the private sector even before they graduate. And I find that that ends up really preparing them very well for the next steps they take in their career. But that sort of diversification, so I would say that's the key recommendation I have, is diversify the portfolio of your research and diversify the places where you can get support for it.
So thank you, Peter Fisk, for sharing all your honest insights into academia and employment trends. And as you've heard, Peter is a big advocate for networking. So I thought I'd ask Elena G. Levine, author of Networking for Nerds, to share her top science network tip.
Networking is not me trying to mine your brain for a job. It's not me trying to get something from you or be sleazy and try and sell you a bad used car. Networking is actually the most honorable thing that a scientist or an engineer can do, because networking is about what can I do for you? What can I do to contribute value to your team? So here's a definition. Networking is a continuous spectrum of activities that starts with that first point of contact, and the beautiful thing about it, the most honorable thing about it, is that it aims for a win-win alliance with the other person, where we're both providing value over time. And it ends only when one or both of us drop dead. So that's networking. It's about building capacity. It's about helping people. It's about contributing value to the other party, to their team, to their organization, to their research group. But now, once you know what networking is, a lot of people ask me, Elena, I went to a conference and I met these people and it was great. Now what do I do? I've networked, but what do I do now? And so what I wanted to talk to you about today is how you actually follow up, the art of the follow-up in networking. See, what happens is once you have that first point of contact, maybe you meet them at the conference or you interacted with them online via LinkedIn or something like that, you have what I call a meaningful engagement, where you perhaps actually have a conversation, an informal conversation, where you explore the potential to collaborate. And then you send them a thank you note, and then what do you do next? So here's how you keep the conversation going, the information flowing, the relationship building, and most importantly, your brand, which is your promise of value, in the forefront of their minds, so that they think of you as somebody who is a problem solver who can help them. And when an opportunity comes up, they call you first. Here's how you do it. You're going to put into your calendar a number of times, between 2 to 4 times over the next year, when you're going to send a follow-up email to these people. And each email should contain strategic information that's designed to solidify and grow that relationship with the other person. In the follow-up email, you can include any or all of the following. And here's your recipe. Number one, you include new information about yourself. So you email me and you say, dear Dr. Levine or dear Elena, it was so nice speaking to you in the summer. Since we last spoke, I won the Nobel Prize, and I thought you might be interested. So you include new information about yourself. It could be a new paper you have out. It could be a new award. It could be just something interesting that you're working on. Number two, you introduce new information about me. Dear Elena, since we last spoke, I saw you won the Nobel Prize in physics and chemistry in the same year. I think that's fantastic. Congratulations. So show me that you've been investing in the relationship, that you're aware of certain things that I've been doing. Number three, include something of value for me, like a link to an article or a link to a video or an introduction to an association or even an introduction to somebody else. Show me that you want to help me do whatever it is that I'm doing by being resourceful, by giving me something of value. And number four, you're going to give me an action item. And this is something that engages me and causes me to want to continue conversing with you. The action item usually is in the form of a yes or no question. It is not meant for me to write out a dissertation. It should not require more than 30 seconds of my brain power to respond to you. But it could be related to any of those other three things. You know, dear Elena, I saw you won the Nobel Prize recently. I saw this article on how to prepare for the Nobel Prize. Here's something of value to you. And have you decided what you will be wearing to the Nobel Prize ceremony in December? So these are things that you can put in the email. And the action item is a quick question that you ask the person that shows them that you're still, that you are truly still invested in the relationship. If you make it a point to follow up with the people you interact with between 2 to 4 times a year with this recipe, with including any one of these 4 things in follow-up email or a combination, you'll stay connected. You'll be able to access and create hidden career opportunities for both you and the other party, and you will see your networking return high dividends to your career adventures.
Thank you very much, Elena. Sad to say that that is it for this month's podcast, but I hope you've enjoyed it and found it useful. If you've decided you want some more useful tips on careers in science, then, of course, you can go to the Nature Jobs website at www.naturejobs.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at Nature Jobs. We're also on Facebook. And please do come back next month, because we've got 2 really inspirational researchers sharing their stories on how they deal with physical and learning disabilities in a scientific research career.
One manager I remember saying at the time, "Oh my gosh, you know, this happened to a girl down our street, and I thought you had such a brilliant career ahead of you." To sort of like put those in the same sentence.
Thanks for listening. I'm Julie Gould.